an opportunity now to change the world. We are all aware of the movement toward women becoming a significant force and the chance for real dynamic change. When things aren't working so well, like now, it becomes a disruptive time. My advice would be to dream and never stop dreaming. Making my dreams come true has always inspired me to work hard. One dream is never enough, and your dream can be molded and finessed along the way to become relevant and successful. Working in fashion is not an extended trip to the mall. Chapter 8. On hiring, staying employed, and firing. I never dreamed about success. I worked for it. Estee Lauder. It's a huge testament to Nasty Gal that so many people want to work there. I'm incredibly proud of the team that I've hired. You would be hard-pressed to find a harder-working, more creative bunch of freaks anywhere in the world. In my relatively short career, I've hired and been hired multiple times, fired and been fired a few times, and stayed employed once. Yay, Nasty Gal. That qualifies me to give advice on all three. On hiring. I was always able to get a job, although keeping it was sometimes a different story. Even when I applied for a minimum wage job at the outlet mall, I handed in a resume with my application, and that resume always had an objective neatly typed out at the top, such as to procure a sales position at a respected retail establishment. If I dropped an application off and wasn't able to speak with the manager in person, I always followed up with a phone call or dropped by again to annoy the establishment into remembering me. I hit the manager with everything that I had, convincing him or her that I wanted nothing more in the world than a chance to spend my afternoons helping old ladies slide their feet into a pair of orthopedic pumps. And that's my first rule of hiring. Although playing hard to get might be cute in the dating world, it won't fly with potential employers. They don't have time to court you, so you had better romance the hell out of them. Competition is stiff, particularly in a tight job market and tough economy. So unless you can sweep someone off his or her feet, unemployed you will stay. Ideally, you'll be applying for a job that you genuinely think is interesting and exciting. If you're not, girl boss, then fake it till you make it. The necessary evil. Cover letters. It had long since come to my attention that people of accomplishment rarely sat back and let things happen to them. They went out and happened to things. Leonardo da Vinci. I love cover letters. Yes, they're painful to write, and trust me, often painful to read, but a cover letter is your first opportunity to make an impression on your future boss. As an employer, when I go through hundreds of applications from people who all have very similar sounding education and experience, cover letters are the only glimpse I have into a person's personality. Cover letters separate the girl bosses from the girls. That said, few people seem to know how to make a cover letter sing. It's incredible how low the bar is, so you're in luck. I'm about to help you navigate the weird, unnatural world of putting your best foot forward in a few paragraphs. Cover letter mistake number one. The cover letter is all about what you want. Nasty Gal gets so many cover letters that detail a passion for fashion, and then proceed to talk about how this job will help the applicant pursue her interests, gain more experience, and explore new avenues. If a cover letter starts out like this, I usually end up reading the first couple of sentences before hitting the delete button. Why? Because I don't care about what a job will do for you and your personal development. I know that sounds harsh, but I don't know you, so the fact that you want to work for my company does not automatically mean that I have an interest in helping you grow your career. I have a business that is growing by the day, so I want to know what you can do for me. It's as simple as that. Cover letter mistake number two. Your cover letter basically says that nothing you've ever done is even remotely applicable to the job you're applying for. When we posted a job for a copywriter a while back, I remember reading an application from someone who had graduated with an MFA in fiction from the Iowa Writers Workshop, one of the most prestigious writing programs in the country. This is what stood out the most to me about her resume, but it wasn't even mentioned in her cover letter. A cover letter can connect the dots between where you've been, where you are, and where you're trying to go. Unless you spell out what is in your cover letter, your potential employer may never know. If you're light on extracurricular activities coming out of college because you had to work 40 hours a week to pay for it, then by all means, make sure that it's obvious. Someone who shows evidence of financial responsibility and work ethic can be just as impressive, if not more so, than someone who is president of the bowling society or secretary of the wine tasting club. Even if you're applying to work at a bowling alley that serves only wine. Okay, maybe not then. Cover letter mistake number 3. You give so-called constructive criticism without being asked. When I'm interviewing people, I often ask what they think Nasty Gal could be doing better, and I'm genuinely interested to hear what they have to say. But detailing the ways that you think a company needs to improve in a cover letter is like meeting someone for the first time and telling her that you think she'd be so much cuter if she lost just 5 pounds. It's distasteful. You would be surprised to learn how often people think that dedicating their entire cover letter to detailing Nasty Gal's flaws is a good idea. It's not. I always want to write these people back and say, opinions are like assholes. Everybody's got one. But I don't, because I'm a girl boss, so I keep it professional-ish. Cover letter mistake number 4. Either you didn't take the time to read it, or you just really, really can't write. In Jason Fried's book, Rework, he writes that one of the smartest investments a business can make is in hiring great writers, and I completely agree. No matter what you are hired to do, you will be infinitely better off if you are able to clearly communicate your ideas. We can't all be Shakespeare, but spend some time on your cover letter and have someone else look it over to make sure it reads well. If it looks like you don't care about your cover letter and rush through it, then I'm going to assume that you will be just as careless in your work. On that note, another piece of advice. Spell check exists for a reason. Use it, but don't rely on it. If you don't know the difference between there, T-H-E-R-E, there, T-H-E-I-R, and there, T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E, you're in bad shape. We're lucky enough in the United States to get by with only having to know one language, so nail the one we've got. If I have to read another email that begins with, I followed Natty Gal since the eBay days, I will throw myself out the window. As we are only on the 3rd floor, that means I will have to deal with a really gnarly sprained ankle, and it will be all your non-thinking, non-spell-checking fault. The resume, more than just a bunch of mumbo-jumbo. There is no question that putting together a resume sucks. How can one boil down all of one's skills, experience, intellect, and advantages onto one piece of paper? I know it's weird, but it's a currency we all have to accept. Regardless of how lame you think the concept of a resume is, you should still make sure that yours is as far away from lame as you can possibly get. As a visual person, I love a creative resume. I'm not a fan of templates. Putting a little effort in on the design side will show that you care as much as I do about things looking good. I like real words on a resume. That means I want to read it and understand it. If you had a job as a marketing manager, be very didactic when you're listing what you did. Built brand relationships within the creative community. Really? What does that mean? Curated artwork, booked bands, secured beverage sponsors, and oversaw budget for an ongoing series of monthly art exhibits. Now that makes sense, and also tells me that you're able to navigate the practicalities that are necessary to bring your ideas to life. We don't need people who just have ideas. We need people who can also execute them. If you've made some shit happen, make sure your resume reflects that. This is one of the few places where it's actually good to brag a bit. The interview. Don't blow it. You wrote a cover letter that was so good it made my mascara run, and now you have an interview. Have you ever walked into a party and felt like everyone was staring at you in judgment? This is why you should not smoke weed at parties. But in all seriousness, at a job interview, this is exactly what happens. Job interviews are intense, and unfortunately, there's no one-size-fits-all study guide for breezing through them. You can say all the right things, have all the right experience, and still not be the right fit for a job. There are millions of unpredictable behind-the-scenes reasons a job does or does not work out. When someone's right for a role, sometimes both parties just know. After a long and grueling search for a marketing position, I finally met someone who I clicked with right away. We had lunch on Thursday, brunch on Sunday, and on Monday he came by the office and left with an offer letter in his hand. He is a little bit wacko, and so am I. And though professional, there wasn't much pretense. I liked that he understood Nasty Gal, was excited about the brand, and was an abstract thinker. His ideas weren't just like everyone else's. When I made him an offer, he said, "You're out of your mind." He meant it as a compliment, and I took it as such. A girl boss knows that she may not nail it on the first try, and that's okay. Remember to be open and keep your head up when something doesn't work out. However, even the best of us can suffer sweaty armpits and a dry mouth during an interview. Here are a few things to know that will hopefully make it easier. Networking is not just for creeps. LinkedIn has made it easier than ever before to connect with people who can help you get ahead. Whether they are doing what you want to be doing or working where you want to be working, it can be as simple as a, "Hey, I came across your profile and would love to grab a coffee sometime. Your experience is really interesting." You can go into a little detail about why you think they're interesting or what you're working on, but some flattery never hurts. As an admitted beast on LinkedIn, I know this from experience. I've hired C-level executives on LinkedIn, creatives on Facebook, and even an intern on Instagram. Treat your LinkedIn profile like an online resume. Please do not wear sunglasses in your profile photo or self-identify as visionary. No profile at all is better than a half-completed one that you stopped caring about after getting 13 connections. Again, a LinkedIn profile can be a first impression, so if it looks like you don't pay much attention to detail, a recruiter can only assume that you take the same approach with your job. I will tell you that networking is yet another subject where my mantra of "you don't get what you don't ask for" applies. I'm friends with Mickey Drexler, the CEO of J.Crew, not because we were introduced, though that would have been much cooler, but because I hunted him down and hunted him down again. He's a great friend and mentor now, and all it took was a nice email to get some of the best business advice I'll ever have. Be prepared to get real. I didn't always get the jobs that I applied for. When I applied at Nordstrom, I didn't get the job because they asked me real questions such as, what did I want out of my career? If you're going into a job interview, you should always be prepared to have smart answers to smart questions, but also smart answers to dumb questions, and it doesn't hurt to practice. Someone will likely ask you, what do you like to do in your free time? And even if your hobbies include watching reruns of Roseanne, you should have a more appropriate answer prepared. The more interesting, memorable, and even unusual that answer is, the better, because as much as your potential employer wants you to be a total rock star at your job, she is also considering you as someone with whom she is going to end up spending 8 hours a day. One of the most standard interview questions is, what do you think is your biggest weakness? It's a question that I ask often, and I want people to answer honestly. Do not answer this question by disguising one of your strengths as a weakness. When people answer me with, "My biggest weakness is that I'm a perfectionist," or "I'm always early to meetings," I just groan, but only on the inside. I'm not that rude. And figure that these are people who aren't really being honest with themselves. I like honesty and I value curiosity, and people who are honest and curious aren't generally impeccable. A girl boss knows where she excels and where she could use some work, so get to know yourself and your weaknesses. And as you can't predict every question you're going to be asked, become familiar with the role you are interviewing for and prepare. Research the company and the job itself, and spend some time thinking about what you personally can bring to the table. Also, be upfront about what you want. Employment is a two-way agreement, so let's be adults. If you are looking for a job that doesn't include certain factors, speak up. The last thing you want is to show up on day one and find out that the job you thought you wanted was in fact the total opposite. But not too real. I've interviewed so many people by now that I swear I can smell crazy a mile away. If you go into too much detail about how you parted with your previous employer, it's a red flag. Even if your boss was a raging lunatic, or you found yourself in a position where you had to work 20-hour days, if you launch into this in an interview, you will come across as an entitled complainer, and an indiscreet one to boot. I recently interviewed someone who described why she had left her previous two jobs. She left one because she got tired of going to the same place every day, and she left the other because she asked for an assistant and her boss said no. Hello? If we hire you, you're going to have to come here every day, and you basically just explained that you bail whenever you don't get what you want. Also, even though our office is a pretty casual environment, don't interpret this as a free pass to be informal. One of our employees recently interviewed someone, and the first thing the candidate said to her when she walked into the room was, "Oh, you look comfy." And done. If you're nervous and don't know what to say, just say nothing. Making small talk about what someone is wearing is just another form of unsolicited feedback. Knowing when to speak up and when to shut up will get you very far, not only in business, but in life. It also always causes me to raise an eyebrow when someone says he or she has been a consultant for the past few years, but can't elaborate on that or put it into concrete accomplishments. It's a mistake to try to bluff about your experience because such posturing usually starts to crack after a few smart questions. But if you were legitimately freelancing, consulting, or running your own business for a while, that says a lot about you. As an entrepreneur, I have a ton of respect for anyone who's willing to give working for themselves a go. Even if you eventually decided it wasn't for you, this kind of experience can still make you stand out. Interview no-nos that may doom you to unemployment. Chewing gum. Bringing things with you. A beverage, a pet, a boyfriend, a child. Leaning back in your chair and crossing your arms. Staring at the floor, out the window, or at the interviewer's boobs. Picking your nose or your nails. Having your phone even visible. Having zero questions. Asking so many questions that it seems like you're interviewing the interviewer. Not writing a thank you email or note. I especially love a handwritten note because to me, someone who knows to have good manners knows how to get what she wants in this world. Dressing like you're headed to a nightclub instead of a job interview. As a female, thinking that you don't have to wear a bra even if you're interviewing at a company with a name like Nasty Gal. So you got a job. Awesome. Now keep it. That's when I first learned that it wasn't enough to just do your job. You had to have an interest in it, even a passion for it. Charles Bukowski. Nasty Gal is not a traditional 9-to-5 company. Everyone here is very passionate about Nasty Gal and believes in what we're doing. We work hard because we're a bunch of girl bosses, and some dude bosses, and we know that we're working on something that's bigger than just us. If you're looking for a job where you can show up, make no impact on the world, and watch a lot of cat videos, this is not the place for you. However, I do know an art school lobby in San Francisco that might be hiring. As a girl boss is ambitious by nature, I'm going to assume that once you get a job, you want to do it well and eventually move up. And though every company is different, here are a few pointers on how to make that happen. The four words thou shalt never mutter. You want to know what four words I probably hate the most? That's not my job. Nasty Gal is not a place where these four words fly. At the end of the day, we're all here for one reason and one reason only, to make the company succeed. And there will undoubtedly be a day, perhaps every day, when you will have to roll up your sleeves and dive in where you're needed. When a company is growing quickly, there will be times when there are holes. There is a job that needs to be done, and there is no one there to do it. A few years back, our warehouse manager gave his 2 weeks' notice exactly 2 weeks before Black Friday. On Thanksgiving night, our creative director, merchandisers, girls from the buying team, me, and whomever else we were able to round up, headed down there and shuffled around a dusty warehouse until 4 a.m., scanning and reclassifying all of our inventory so we could ensure that the people who shopped with us on one of the most important retail days of the year actually got the clothes that they ordered. At 2 a.m., as I was counting and recounting bustiers, I did not give a shit whether people were creative or whether they loved fashion. I was just thankful to have employees who were willing, even enthusiastic, to step up and work hard. In an ideal world, you'd never have to do things that are below your position. But this isn't an ideal world, and it's never going to be. You have to understand that even a creative job isn't just about being creative, but about doing the work that needs to get done. The girl boss who is willing to do a job that is below her and above is the one who stands out. Above, you ask? Yes. Sometimes you'll find an opportunity to step in when your boss is out or just swamped and show your worth. You're as smart as she is anyway, so figure it out as you go and make it look like child's play. It's that attitude and behavior that will get you ahead. God and a promotion is in the details. Be a nice person at work. It doesn't matter how talented you are. If you are a total terror to work with, no one will want to keep you around. And the worst kind of mean is selective mean. People who are nice to their boss and superiors, but completely rude to their peers or subordinates. If you are a habitual bitch to the front desk girl, the security guard, or even the Starbucks staff downstairs, that news will eventually make its way up the chain, and the top of the chain ain't gonna like it. Own up to your mistakes and apologize for them. Everyone will make a mistake at some point, and the sooner you can admit where you went wrong, the sooner you can start to fix it. Be honest with yourself about yourself and your abilities. Many people accept titles that are beyond their experience to only later find themselves up to their neck in problems they can't solve, and too embarrassed to admit they weren't qualified in the first place. And what's the first rule about holes? If you're in one, stop digging. Boundaries found. Your boss is not your friend, and if you're the boss, your employees aren't your friends. I learned this the hard way when I was out to dinner one night with someone who used to report to me. It was right after I bought the Porsche, and I was babbling on about how flashy it was and how much of a cheese ball I sometimes felt like driving it. However, instead of listening as a friend, she took this honesty about my insecurities as an opportunity to insult and said, "Well, you know, you'd better be careful because people are saying, oh, now I'm doing my job to pay for a Porsche." While I still don't believe anyone but the person I was with had an issue with my auto purchase, it quickly had me bawling into my rosé. Yet it taught me a lesson. While it's okay to be friends with my investor, it's not okay to be friends with my direct reports. If you need someone to listen as you drag your psyche across the coals, find a friend or a therapist, but don't do it with someone you're expected to manage on a daily basis. At a company like Nasty Gal, which seems very informal and where there are a lot of young people, the managerial lines can sometimes get blurry. If you treat your reports like your peers, your team won't respect you further down the road when you have to play a trump card or put your foot down. I'll go for drinks with people. I'll dance at parties. But at the end of the day, people know that when I give someone a deadline, it's not up for discussion. You are not a special snowflake. Millennials got so many participation trophies growing up that a recent study showed that 40% believe they should be promoted every 2 years, regardless of performance. Joel Stein in Time magazine. From one speed demon to another, let me be straight with you. Slow your roll. You got a job. That's great. But you need to get your hands dirty and spend time proving yourself before you ask for a raise or a promotion. 4 months are not enough, and neither are 8. At the bare minimum, you need to be in your position for a year before you ask for a raise or title change. Even then, that's if and only if you've been going above and beyond doing work that's outside your job description and generally making yourself completely indispensable to your employer. A lot of people in my generation don't seem to get that you have to work your way up. An entry-level job is precisely that, entry-level, which means that you're not going to be running the show or getting to work on the most fun and creative projects. I've heard so many people in their 20s complain about their jobs because they have so much more to offer. But first and foremost, you have to do the job that you're there to do. I don't care if filing invoices is beneath you. If you don't do it, who do you think is going to? Your boss? Nope. That's why she hired you. I know you've probably grown up with your parents telling you that you're special every day for the past 20 years. It's okay, my parents did too. But you still have to show up and work hard just like everyone else. If you're a girl boss, you should want to work harder than everybody else. It takes a lot more than just knowing how to put an outfit together to succeed in the fashion industry. So more power to you if this is where you want to be. Just don't expect it to be an extended trip to the mall. And if you're a cute girl expecting to just get by on her looks, go apply elsewhere. We've already got a ton of cute girls working at Nasty Gal, and they're all busting ass. The firing line. There is no way around it, and it doesn't matter which side of the desk you're on. Getting fired straight up sucks. One of the many jobs I was fired from was a sales associate job at a luxury shoe store in San Francisco. I was a crummy 21-year-old, not as dirty as I had been, but still not completely clean, hawking shoes by Maison Martin Margiela, Miu Miu, and Dries Van Noten with quadruple-digit price tags. At that time, I stayed out all night and showed up to work semi-showered, wearing the same red polyester flares day after day as I sold Prada pumps to rich ladies. I didn't care about Prada, and I didn't get that I was supposed to pretend. As I write this, I am in love with a particular pair of Prada shoes that I'm considering buying, so oh, how times have changed. But back then, I was indignant about it. Who is spending this kind of money on shoes? I made $12 an hour with no commission as these women from Pacific Heights, a pretty she-she neighborhood in San Francisco, would come in and I would have to smile and be all like, "Hi, how are you? Let me know if there's anything I can help you with." While inside I was thinking, "I hate you." The store made the salespeople wear the shoes too, so I had a pair of Dries Van Noten pumps that were so scuffed they could have been vintage. They weren't special to me, so I wore them to work and burrito shops alike. On Sundays, I worked by myself and was given 30 minutes to close the store for my lunch break. Time came, I flipped the sign on the door, locked up, and walked down the street to order a hamburger. The burger took forever, and I was hungry. This, coupled with my pathetic sense of time, caused me to be super late to open the store back up. When you make $12 an hour and you're spending $8 on a burger, you had damn well better make it count. When I finally made it back to the store well past my 30-minute lunch break, the owner was there. I'd been perpetually late, perpetually grimy, and I'm sure this had been a long time coming. She collected my key, gave me my final paycheck, and sent me on my way. This was actually the last time that I was fired. 7 years later, I can't quit, and no one can fire me. Telling someone you're fired. Generally, I like other people to fire because it's always a lousy task. Donald Trump. Sadly, it wasn't too long after I took Nasty Gal off eBay that I had to fire someone for the first time. When I first hired someone to oversee shipping, the business was still just Christina and me. We were 22-year-olds managing a grown man who, on his third day of work, asked if he could leave early because it was grocery day for his family. Sweet, but no. It was also apparent that he had never used a computer before. He was completely stumped when a box popped up on the screen. It says Norton Antivirus. What do I do? Christina and I both screamed, "Oh my God, just click the X!" I started to panic because I had hired this guy to make my life easier, and it was clear that this was not going to be the case at all. We also hired a copywriter who, in my weaker moments, I started to think was a spy sent by a competitor to sabotage the business from the inside, because there was no way in hell his mistakes could be for real. Time after time, I would say, "Please use spell check and stop having so many typos." But then everything he wrote looked like it had been done by my poodle who was pecking at the keyboard with her nose. I knew he had to go, and it was torturous for me. I read up on all the legal responsibilities of firing someone and went through all the different scenarios in my head. If he said this, I was going to say that. If he asked that, I was going to explain it like this. When I finally, practically hyperventilating, sat him down and told him we were letting him go, he was totally calm about it.
Okay, he shrugged. No problem.
And he left. The harsh truth is that not everyone you hire is going to work out. It's impossible to know everything about a person's talent, judgment, and character without actually working with him or her. In many cases, the people who don't work out are people about whom I had second thoughts from day one. However, sometimes it is simply a matter of a fast-growing company growing faster than the people inside it. The person who was right for a job a year ago might not be the person for the job a year from now. Don't get me wrong, I'm loyal to every person I've hired. But my loyalty lies with the greater business, which means the hundreds of others whose jobs could be at stake if we have the wrong person in the wrong role. I know this sounds harsh, but it's that level of objectivity that leaders need to have. And leading is, after all, what I'm ultimately here to do. If someone who is working for you keeps screwing up, make sure you talk to her about it. There's always the slight off chance that maybe that employee doesn't know that she is doing anything wrong, and it's something that she can easily fix. Everyone should be given the opportunity to improve. But if you think you're going to have to fire someone, start documenting everything. People who get fired love to say shit like, "The only reason I got fired was because that bitch didn't like me." Chances are that if you're ready to fire someone, you probably don't like that person, and that's okay. Just keep your cool and be professional, because it's not about that. It's because someone sucks that you have to do this, not because you suck. If your company has a human resources department, make sure that they're aware of what's going on. If you can write someone up, write someone up. Sadly, sometimes the ship can't be righted. So when it comes time to actually do it, don't pussyfoot about and don't act like a baby. As Voltaire said, with great power comes great responsibility. If you want to be a boss and be treated like a boss, then firing someone is in your boss-sized job description. Don't ever try to impress upon the person you're about to fire how hard the situation is for you, because that person is losing his or her job, so it's obviously harder on them. Resist the urge to overexplain or even to apologize. Keep it as short and sweet as you possibly can, because the more personal you try to make it, the more personally your soon-to-be ex-employee is going to take it. However, it doesn't hurt to take a few minutes to put yourself in their shoes and consider how you would want to be treated if you were in that position. And if you both learn from your lessons, neither of you will make the mistakes that led to that situation again. Hearing you're fired. I didn't see it then, but it turned out that getting fired from Apple was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. Steve Jobs. Though I was fired a few times, and usually from jobs I couldn't have cared less about, I still was never like the copywriter who just shrugged and walked out the door. Getting fired was always a big deal to me. It's a bit like having someone break up with you. Even if you know it wasn't the right situation, and that you'll be way better in the long run, it's still rejection. And rejection sucks. But getting fired, especially from a job you're not actually that into, isn't the end of the world. For me, getting fired from the shoe store was an opportunity to find a job with health insurance. And though I got the job at the art school primarily to fix my hernia, I ended up with a lot more than I bargained for. The inspiration to start something that led me to where I am today. Getting fired can be a much-needed wake-up call, a push in the right direction, or an escape route. Or it can just plain suck. But no matter what the details of the situation, how much you learn from it is entirely up to you. It can also be the end of the world, or at least feel like it, if you've got zero savings. If you're living paycheck to paycheck already, and all of a sudden there's no more paycheck, that's terrifying. I don't want to get all told you so, but the fact that you could get fired, and almost all of us could get fired, is all the more reason to consistently save 10% of those earnings. Instead of calling it a rainy day fund, let's call it an oh shit fund. And you'll be saying oh shit a lot less if you've got one. Here is a list of things to not do if you get fired. Call anyone a bitch or an asshole or any variations thereof. Threaten to sue. If you do think you have a legitimate reason, talk to a lawyer before you do anything. Try to get your former coworkers to take your side. As sympathetic as they might be, they're going to be worried about their own jobs.
take to the internet to complain or talk shit about your boss or your former employer. People have a lot of Facebook friends these days, and chances are you have a couple on your friend list whom you've forgotten about. Use the person who fired you as a reference without first asking him or her if it's cool. Draw attention to yourself upon departure. Flipping the bird to the executive team on your way out will not make things any better. Have your mom or dad call. Yep, this has happened. Now, recently fired girl boss, get thee on with thy life. Portrait of a Girl Boss. Christine Barbaric, Refinery 29, Editor-in-Chief. I always knew I wanted to be a writer and an editor. There was never a choice, it's all I ever wanted to do. My first real publishing job was as an assistant at The New Yorker, but my editorial training happened at Gourmet Magazine. In terms of striking out on my own and being brave in my convictions, I learned that mostly by being freelance. I don't think you can truly know what you're made of until you are in charge of your days. How you use that time and the work you pursue teaches you so much about who you are and what you can become. It's possible I figured out what I want to do by people telling me I couldn't or shouldn't do it. It's really astounding how discouraging people can be, especially if it's something that seems particularly risky. But, you know, risk can be thrilling. I've often made hard career choices based on how scared I was of the opportunity. When the stakes are high, I'm talking cataclysmic level change, success or failure. Sometimes you just have to jump, screaming the whole fucking way. I don't know if there is any greater feeling than proving you are your own biggest advocate. And all that noise out there is seriously just bullshit. My mom is the hardest worker I know. She taught me that showing up is the most important part of any role. And of course, my team inspires me hourly. It is because of them that I read a lot and never, ever take anything for granted. Simply by being so smart and curious, they inspire me to be an excellent editor, a courageous leader, and someone who motivates them to create cool and special stuff. When you're collaborating with other people, it's important to know what you don't know and to find the best person in that area to teach you. Be a leader, even in terms of one, because in the beginning, there's a lot of that. You have to listen, really listen, and root for other people's success. That's a big one, because it won't always be you, but eventually it will be. For me, creativity isn't just in my work. It's how I think and live my life. It's not necessarily about always creating something new, but simply having the space and freedom to let something special happen. It's how I bring beauty and joy into my surroundings and my relationships. I like to be challenged. Seeing or reading something that opens my eyes or gives me chills is the whole point of everything. My advice to aspiring girl bosses: as hard as it is, stop caring so much about what other people think. Find a way to hear what you want. Recognize what is your dream. And then put everything you have into that: your work, the relationships you surround yourself with, the food you put in your body. Everything you have control over in your world should feed that dream and make you feel like a girl boss. Dream big, start small. Chapter 9. Taking care of your business. Things may come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle. Abraham Lincoln. I never started a business. I started an eBay store and ended up with a business. I never would have done it had I known it was going to become this big. I was 22, and like most 22-year-olds, I was looking for a way to pay my rent and buy my Starbucks chai. Had someone shown me the future of where Nasty Gal would be in 2014, I would have gasped in revulsion, thinking, oh hell no, that is way too much work. The name of the company alone should clue you into this fact. Who would have thought that a company called Nasty Gal could be so successful? I sure as shit never intended to be saying those two words all day, every day, 7 years later. There are different kinds of entrepreneurs. There are the ones who start a business because they're educated and choose to, and the ones who do it because it is really the only option. I definitely fall into the latter category. I consider myself completely unemployable and wanted to give one last shot at my ideal of being jobless. and boy did being jobless work for me. Nasty Gal would have surely failed had it been my goal to grow a business to the size that I have today. When you begin with the finish line in mind, you miss all the fun stuff along the way. The better approach is to tweak and grow, tweak and grow. I call it the incremental potential. In e-commerce, you have to get everything right, from the marketing to the product descriptions to the checkout process. Because I started small, I think I inherently did that from the beginning. Customer service was my number one priority. A lot of people run their businesses like their customers are dummies. This is a mistake. If you're just out to take their money, they know it. But if you genuinely care about what you're doing, they will respond. I knew my customers and knew what they liked because I was my customer. And rather than dictating what I thought my customers should buy and wear, I listened instead. If I bought something and they hated it, I moved on. Rather than force my idea of what Nasty Gal should be on my customers, I let them tell me along the way. Nasty Gal felt like the best-dressed girl's best-kept secret, except that it was a secret she really wanted to share. As I mentioned earlier, one key to running a successful business is to know how to get free marketing. Rule number one, that's simple. Just do a good job. Through the styling, photography, and voice of the brand, Nasty Gal was an exciting place to shop. But if our customers weren't equally as stoked when they were holding one of our products in their hands, then that excitement lived and died on the internet. I don't take it lightly when someone buys something from me. I know that there are a million places where people can buy a dress, a crop top, or a pair of shoes, so I want to make sure that if someone is buying it from Nasty Gal, she feels like it's worth it. We're dressing girls for the best years of their lives, so whether you drop $300 or shop the sale section, I want you to look and feel like $1 million. Rule number two, keep your promises. When girls bought something from Nasty Gal, what they got in the mail was just as amazing as what they'd seen online. Customers became not only loyal, but also evangelical. They came back again and again and shared their excitement with their friends, frequently on the internet. It was the kind of natural word of mouth that can't be bought. Rule number three, give your customers something to share. Social media is built on sharing, and Nasty Gal was giving girls something amazing to share each and every day. Whether it was a crazy vintage piece, a quote, or a behind-the-scenes photo, we have always worked hard to create the best and most compelling images, words, and content for our customers. At most companies, the person manning the Twitter and Facebook accounts is far from the top of the food chain. But at Nasty Gal, even though I'm not always composing every tweet, I still read every comment. If our customers are unhappy about something, I hear it first. At other businesses, it might take months for customer feedback to filter up to the CEO, if at all. Social media allows me to have my ear to the ground even when I'm out pounding the pavement. When Nasty Gal joined Snapchat, it meant that I joined Snapchat. I sent out a few snaps, and our customers responded in force. There's nothing more thrilling than sending private texts directly to a customer and seeing what she has to say in response. Call me crazy, but I truly believe that Nasty Gal is a feeling. And though our community lives in many different places, it's that feeling that unifies our customers and makes us about much more than selling clothes. The incremental potential. Author Malcolm Gladwell believes that one can be an expert at something after putting in 10,000 hours of practice. Needless to say, my 10,000 hours are far behind me. Had I waited to finish a business plan or waited for investors to validate my idea, my 10,000-hour clock might never have begun. Don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking business plans. What I intend to illustrate is that just going for it can be much more rewarding. Business plans are just a starting point. The best entrepreneurs know to listen along the way and adjust things, including their business plan. This advice applies to life as well, dear girl boss. Turn on the jets and ready, set, listen. Starting a business is risky no matter which way you look at it, but it's much riskier when you have a ton of overhead and money guys anxiously waiting to earn a return on their investment. Starting a business also takes a lot of personal sacrifice. If you start a business, expect that you're probably going to be broke for a long time. If you're not broke, consider yourself broke because, as we discussed earlier, it is short-sighted to pay yourself a big salary too early. Dream big all you want. That's what this entire book is about. But know that the first step toward those dreams is probably going to be a small one. Many people mistake the glamour of business for business. One of my pet peeves includes entrepreneurs who issue press releases about their new venture before making their first dollar. I waited until I knew for sure that I had something to say before talking to the press about anything, which took about 5 years. While media coverage can boost sales and garner attention from the business community, tooting your own horn too early can put you under the spotlight when you're still figuring out the basics of running your business. I've seen many a startup disappear after making a big splash in the press. Though I'm rarely surprised, it feels good to be the fabled turtle in this scenario rather than the hare. I didn't know anybody to turn to for business advice, and because of this, people ask me all the time how I figured it out. Well, I figured it out by doing what I think is one of the best strategies for learning anything anywhere. I Googled it. There is a whole wide world of free education out there for anyone who wishes to take advantage of it. Granted, a book might cost you $13, but that's pennies compared with college tuition. When I needed to know what kinds of shelving to buy for the warehouse, I Google image searched warehouse shelving and spent an afternoon looking at pictures of shelves until I figured out which ones would be the best for our needs. I turned to YouTube to watch experts speak at conferences I wouldn't have been invited to even if I had been able to afford to attend. I learned a ton about how to structure Nasty Gal by looking at similar businesses to see who they had hired and were hiring. I then viewed those people's profiles on LinkedIn to see what types of experience it takes to do that job successfully. And while I took it all with a grain of salt, it got me far. Nasty Gal is now big enough for me to be able to hire people who are experts in their respective fields. But don't be fooled. I'm still calling the shots. I hate it when I'm in a meeting with one of our top officers and someone addresses her the entire time, assuming that the adult in the room must be the one making the decisions. Don't you dare think that my shredded t-shirt makes me a sheep in wolf's clothing. I, like every girl boss, am a wolf in wolf's clothing. Entrepreneurialism is an 18-letter word. All humans are entrepreneurs, not because they should start companies, but because the will to create is encoded in human DNA. Reid Hoffman, co-founder of LinkedIn. I think everyone should tap into their entrepreneurial spirit. However, I don't think everyone should be an entrepreneur. Harvard Business School professor Howard Stevenson famously defined entrepreneurship as the pursuit of opportunity without regard to resources currently controlled. I give a hell yes to that definition, and you should take that spirit with you to whatever job you're doing or whatever project you're undertaking. When I was 22, the thought of rising up within an organization was completely incomprehensible. To me, office jobs were like school, where the best way to get along was to show up on time, not ask questions, follow all the rules, and not make a fuss. Again, not my jam. However, that accepted paradigm is changing, and faster than ever. As Seth Godin points out in his book Lynchpin, our society's existing ideas of education and employment are held over from a time when most jobs were in factories. People were trained to do exactly what they were told, and only what they were told, in order to keep things running smoothly. Following the rules without question was precisely what got someone promoted. Thankfully, though, this is changing. And in Lynchpin, Godin elaborates that it's becoming clear that people who reject the worst of the current system are actually more likely to succeed. If you need proof of that, well, hi, here I am. What I'm getting at here is that you can be entrepreneurial without being an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurial people are passionate about what they do, comfortable with taking risks, and quick at moving on from failures. These are all things I look for in the people I hire. I want problem solvers who take nothing at face value. I want people who fight for their ideas, even fight with me. I want people who are comfortable with disagreement. And I need people who sometimes, after all of that, hear the word no and get right back up to work even harder. There are a lot of companies changing the way they do things right now. It's a pretty exciting time to be in business, but only if you're surrounded by exciting people. The Nasty Gal Philosophy. Businesses often forget about the culture, and ultimately they suffer for it because you can't deliver good service from unhappy employees. Tony Hsieh, Zappos CEO and author of Delivering Happiness. At Nasty Gal, we have something we like to call our philosophy. It's a set of directives that align us to stay focused on what really matters. We design them really nice and pretty and have them posted up around our offices as a little daily reminder of why we're all here. Even if you never land that coveted buying job in our headquarters, these ideas can be applied to any career path you choose. Nasty Gal Obsessed. We keep our customer at the center of everything we do. Without customers, we have nothing. Own it. Take the ball and run with it. We make smart decisions, put the business first, and do more with less. People are important. Reach out, make friends, build trust. No assholes. We leave our egos at the door. We are respectful, collaborative, curious, and open-minded. Learn on. What we're building has never been built before. The future is ours to write. We get excited about growth, take intelligent risks, and learn from our mistakes. Have fun and keep it weird. On Investors. When I lived in San Francisco, my friends and I existed far outside the tech scene that made our rents so expensive. Broke as a joke, drinking Amstel Light and disco dancing in dive bars, we couldn't have been further removed. VC might as well have stood for Velveeta cheese, for all I knew. I just wondered who all of these people were walking around in their hoodies and their white earbuds. Little did I know, they were the reason some of my favorite burrito joints had become extinct. When the time came for me to grow familiar with the concept of investors, it was still pretty intimidating. My first meeting with venture capitalists was scary. For one, I had never been in a boardroom, and it didn't take me long to realize we were speaking completely different languages. I felt like a little kid who had no place at the table. For about a year after that, whenever anyone reached out about investing in Nasty Gal, I just didn't respond. Then I had to fire a really senior executive. And though it had no linear relationship to taking investment, it was a pretty gnarly experience that drove home the fact that if I was going to be a CEO, which I already was, and run a really big, fast-growing company, which I already was, I was going to have to do some stuff I didn't like. I grew some balls and finally decided to answer some of those calls. I headed up to Silicon Valley to meet with investors. In San Francisco, I picked up my friend Diego, a fellow entrepreneur and one of the smartest people I know. He had already been through the process of raising venture capital, so we powwowed in the car as I picked his brain. It was my crash course and I needed it. I was in and out of 6 meetings that day, all with different firms. This time around, I knew that I had nothing to lose. Nasty Gal was kicking ass, profitable, and had money in the bank. Either way, we were going to be fine. While most entrepreneurs meet investors with a presentation on what they plan to do with their business, I, being my PowerPoint challenged self, arrived empty-handed. It turned out that Nasty Gal's strongest selling point wasn't what we were going to do, but what we'd already done. We're going to do $100 million this year. No, I've never borrowed a dime. No, I didn't go to college. No, I don't have previous experience running a business. I got pretty accustomed to saying all of those things, and as I knocked down meeting after meeting, something pretty shocking dawned on me. Holy shit, these people are impressed. Sand Hill Road is the most legendary venture capital hub in Menlo Park between Stanford University and Silicon Valley. The people who sit in those offices operate in a very different paradigm than I do, spending their days talking business models and IPOs in a way that I never will. It was strangely encouraging for me to come out of nowhere with instant respect from people I felt were an entirely different species. Some of them wanted to be my friends, and others tried to appeal to my edgy side. And FYI, edgy ranks right up there with twerk, yummy, and redonkulous on my list of least favorite words. One investor left me a strange late-night voicemail and then apologized for it on the phone next day. "Sorry about that," he said. "I was all messed up on Percocet and Jack Daniels." I'd be freaked out if a friend said something like that, so needless to say, I did not go with that firm. It seemed most of the venture capitalists I met with had recently and unanimously discovered that women liked to buy things online. They were super stoked on the idea of a female-run business that sold things to women. I happened to check a lot of the boxes that they were excited about at the time, but they had no idea why Nasty Gal was special. It was obvious to me that their ideas weren't their own. One person asked to call my former COO, Frank, to talk about the business. I said sure, and gave him Frank's number. I later found out that he had asked if I had a spending problem. When I heard this, I thought to myself, dude, I built a multi-million dollar business out of $50 and no debt. Does it look like I have a spending problem? The only person I liked was Danny Reimer. Danny's company, Index Ventures, was based in Europe and had just opened their U.S. office far from Silicon Valley, in San Francisco's SoMa neighborhood, where the startups were. Danny had also already been investing in great fashion companies since before the other guys knew what fashion was, like ASOS and Net-a-Porter. So I knew that he was interested in Nasty Gal because he truly got us, not because we were the hot ticket. Danny had a brand, and I get brands. Index had chosen to surround itself with the best entrepreneurs and the best companies. I realized that, just as all department stores are not created equal,